the windscreen with the end of her velvet scarf. "Well, we can't stop. We're running late, and I can't have you missing the ferry." Her mother was a generally mild-mannered soul, but Sabine knew that note of steel in Kate's voice, that it said nothing short of a tsunami was going to prevent Sabine getting on that ferry. It was not a huge surprise. It was a note she had come up against many times in the past 3 weeks, but having to hear yet another reinforcement of her ultimate powerlessness in the face of her mother made Sabine's lower lip jut unconsciously and her body turn away in mute protest. Kate, finely tuned to her daughter's mercurial moods, noted it and looked away. "You know, if you weren't so busy being determined to hate this, you might just have a good time." "How can I have a good time? You're sending me to a place I've been to all of twice in my whole life, to stay in Box City, with a grandmother you like so much you haven't seen her in bloody years, to be some kind of domestic skivvy while my grandfather pops his clogs. Great, some holiday. I'm just gagging for it. Oh, look, they're working again. Let's see if we can make it to the port." Kate wrenched the wheel, and the battered Volkswagen lurched forward onto the wet road, sending tea-coloured fans of spray up at each side window. "Look, we don't know that your grandfather is that ill. He's just frail, apparently. And I think it will be good for you to get away from London for a bit. You've hardly met your granny at all, and it'll be nice for you to see a bit of each other before she gets too old or you go travelling or whatever." Sabine stared determinedly out of her side window. "Granny, you make it sound like happy families. And I know she's ever so grateful for the help." Still, she refused to look. She knew bloody well why she was being shipped off to Ireland, and her mother knew it. And if she was such a bloody hypocrite that she wasn't going to admit it, then she couldn't expect Sabine to be straight with her either. "Left lane," she said, still not turning round. "What? Left lane. You need to be in the left lane for the ferry terminal." "Oh, for God's sake, Mum, why can't you just wear your bloody glasses?" Kate wrenched the little car into the left lane, ignoring the beeps of protest behind her, and under Sabine's bad-tempered direction, eased it over to the windswept sign that indicated foot passengers. She drove until she could see a place to park, a grey, windswept tarmac desert in the shadow of a featureless grey Lubyanka. "Why do they make offices look so dispiriting?" she wondered absently, as if people weren't already miserable enough when they got there. When the car and its wipers stopped again, the rain obligingly ensured that the building was swiftly erased, turning everything outside into an impressionistic blur. Kate, for whom most things without her glasses were an impressionistic blur, gazed at the outline of her daughter and wished suddenly that they could have the kind of fond farewells that she was sure other mothers and daughters practiced. She wanted to tell her she was bitterly sorry that Jeff was going, and that for the third time in her young life their domestic arrangements were going to be in upheaval. She wanted to tell her that she was sending her to Ireland to protect her, to save her from witnessing the kind of bitter scenes that she and Jeff had barely been suppressing as they ended their 6-year relationship. And she wanted to tell her that even though Sabine and Kate no longer had any kind of relationship, Kate wanted her to feel like she had some kind of grandmother, someone other than just her. But Sabine always made it impossible for her to say anything. She was seemingly covered in an ever-growing coat of spikes, like a glamorous, sulky little porcupine. If Kate told her she loved her, she was told off for being so little house on the prairie. If she reached out to hug her, she felt her child flinch in her arms. "How did this come about?" she asked herself repeatedly. "I was so determined that our relationship would be different, that you would have all the freedoms I was denied, that we would be friends. How did you come to despise me?" Kate had become an expert at hiding her feelings from her daughter. Sabine hated it even more if she got needy and emotional. It made her even more prickly. Instead, She reached into her overflowing basket bag and handed over the tickets, as well as what she considered a generous amount of spending money. Sabine didn't acknowledge it. Now, the crossing will take around 3 hours. It looks like it might be a bit rough, but I'm afraid I didn't bring anything for seasickness. You'll get into Ross Lair at around 4:30, and Granny will meet you at the information desk. Do you want me to write any of that down? I think I can just about remember information desk, said Sabine dryly. Well, if anything does go wrong, I've put the phone numbers for the house on the back of the ticket holder. And ring me when you get there, just so I know you've arrived. Making sure the coast is clear, thought Sabine bitterly. Her mother must really think she was stupid. She must really think she didn't know what was going on. There had been so many times in the past few weeks where she had wanted to scream at her. I know, you know. I know why you and Jeff are splitting up. I know about you and Justin bloody Stewartson. And that's why you're shipping me out of the way for a few weeks, so you can carry on your disgusting little affair with both me and Jeff gone. But somehow, despite all her anger, she had never quite had the appetite for it. Because her mother had just seemed too sad, too droopily miserable about it all. Still, if Kate thought Sabine was going to go quietly, she was mistaken. They sat in the car for a few minutes. Periodically, the rain would ease and they would get a glimpse of the unlovely terminal in front of them. But then it would beat down again, turning the picture into a watercolour bleed. So, will Jeff be gone when I get back? Sabine lifted her chin as she said this, so that it sounded more defiant than inquiring. Kate gazed at her. Probably, she said slowly. But you can still see him any time you want. Like I could see Jim any time I wanted. You were a lot younger then, darling, and it got complicated because Jim got a new family. No, it got complicated because I got one bloody stepfather after another. Kate's hand stretched out to her daughter's arm. Why did no one tell you that childbirth was the easiest pain? I'd better go, muttered Sabine, opening the car door. I wouldn't want to miss my ferry. Let me walk you over to the terminal, said Kate, tears stinging her eyes. Don't bother, said Sabine. And with the hollow slam of the door, Kate was alone. It was a rough crossing, rough enough for screaming children to whiz up and down the carpeted walkway on stolen dinner trays, while their parents slid comfortably backwards and forwards along plastic-covered benches, drinking from cans of Red Stripe, and occasionally breaking into noisy explosions of laughter. Others queued, staggering, for overpriced chips at the cafeteria, ignoring the salads wilting under cling film, or played the slot machines, which broadcast jangles and sirens alongside the stairs. Judging by the number of families and the resolute postponing of hangovers, the Sunday afternoon crossing was popular among weekend trippers. Sabine sat in a window seat, her personal stereo closeting her from all the irritating people around her. They seemed to be grown from the same stock as the people she saw in motorway service stations or supermarkets. People who didn't care that much what they wore, whether their haircuts were so last year, whether the way they sat or spoke was likely to be embarrassing. This is what Ireland is going to be like, she told herself grimly, above the bass heavy sound of her CD. Backward, culture-free, an anti-cool zone. For the millionth time she cursed her mother for this exile, this removal from her friends, her manner, her normal life. It was going to be a nightmare. She had nothing in common with these people. Her grandparents were virtual strangers. She was leaving Dean Baxter to the evil clutches of Amanda Gallagher just at the point where she thought she was getting somewhere with him. And, worst of all, she wouldn't even have her mobile phone or computer to keep in touch. Even she had to admit that her computer was too large to transport, while her mother had told her that if Sabine thought she was going to pay to have an international call facility on her already overspent mobile, then she had another think coming. Why did they say that? If she had told her mother she had a think coming, her mother would have started on about how she should have sent her to private school. So she was not only to be exiled, but without even the comforts of phone or email. But even as she sat staring grimly at the churning Irish Sea, Sabine allowed herself the smallest sense of relief that she wasn't going to have to be party to the endless tension of her mother and Jeff slowly and painfully unravelling their domestic web. She had known it was going to happen even before Jeff had. She had known from the afternoon she came down from her room and heard her mother whispering into the phone, "I know. I want to see you too. But you know he's impossible at the moment, and I don't want to make things worse." She had stood frozen on the stairs, then coughed loudly. Her mother put the phone down suddenly and guiltily, then said, too brightly, when she walked into the living room, "Oh, it's you, sweetheart. I didn't hear you out there. I was just thinking, what shall we have for supper?" Her mother didn't cook supper. She was a useless cook. It was Jeff's job. And then she had met him, Justin Stewartson, photographer on a left-leaning national newspaper, a man so full of self-importance that he had caught the tube rather than travel in her mother's battered car, a man who thought he was it because he wore a leather jacket that might have been cool about 5 years ago, and khaki-coloured trousers with desert boots. He had tried too hard to talk to Sabine, throwing in comments about underground bands that he thought she would know, trying to sound both cynical and knowledgeable about the music business. She had given him what she hoped was a withering look. She knew why he was trying to be friendly, and it wouldn't wash. And men over 35 could never be cool, not even if they thought they knew about music. Poor old Jeff. Poor fusty old Jeff. He had sat at home, brow furrowed as he worried night after night about patients he couldn't get sectioned, ringing round all the psychiatric units in central London in an effort to stop some other nutter ending up on the streets. He hadn't had a bloody clue, and her mother had drifted in and out distantly, pretending to sound as if she cared, until the day that Sabine came downstairs, and it was obvious that he knew, because he gave her one of those long, searching glances like, "Did you know? Et tu, Brute?" It was difficult to fool Jeff because of his psychiatric training. So when she stared back at him, she tried to convey sympathy and disapproval at her mother's pathetic actions. She didn't let either of them know how hard she had cried. Jeff had been irritating and a bit earnest, and she had never let him think he was a dad of sorts. But he had been kind, and he had cooked and kept Mum sane, and he had been around since she was a kid, longer than any of the others, in fact. Besides, the thought of Mum and Justin Stewartson doing it made her want to vomit. The announcement that Ross Lair was now a few minutes away came at just after 4:30. Sabine slid out of her seat and made her way to the foot passenger's disembarkation point, trying to ignore the little flutter of nervousness in her stomach. She had only travelled alone once before, and that had been a disastrous holiday flight out to join Jim, her mother's previous partner, in Spain. He had wanted to reassure her that she was still family. Her mother had wanted to reassure her that she still had a father of sorts. The British Airways stewardess had wanted to reassure her that she was a very big girl, as she was to be travelling alone. But even from the moment Jim had met her at the airport, with his heavily pregnant, wary-eyed new girlfriend trailing in his wake, she had known it was going to be a disaster. She had only seen him once after that, when he had been trying to get her involved with a new baby. The girlfriend had looked at her as if she wanted Sabine to get as uninvolved as possible. She didn't blame her, really. The baby wasn't a blood relative after all, and she wouldn't have wanted some kid from a previous relationship hanging around like a lost soul. The doors opened, and Sabine found herself transported along the walkway, hemmed in on all sides by chattering people. She wondered about putting her earphones back on, but she was afraid of missing some vital announcement. The last thing she wanted was to have to ring her mother and tell her she'd got it wrong. She glanced around her, wondering what her grandmother was going to look like. The most recent picture she had of her had been taken more than 10 years ago, when she had last been to the Irish house. She had only the most distant memories of it. But the picture showed a dark-haired woman, high-boned and handsome, smiling reservedly down at her as she patted a small grey pony. "What if I don't recognise her?" she thought anxiously. "Was she likely to be offended? Her birthday and Christmas cards were always short and formal, not the kind of writing to suggest a sense of humour. From the little her mother said, it was all too easy to do the wrong thing." Then she spotted him, standing leaning against a desk, which might or might not have been the information point, holding up a piece of card with the word Sabine on it. He was medium height, wiry-looking, with thick dark hair cut close against his head, probably the same age as her mother. Also, she noted as she walked over slowly, he had only one arm. The other extended into a semi-clawed plastic hand, in the kind of unrelaxed pose more commonly seen on shop display dummies. She put her hand unconsciously to her hair, checking that it hadn't flattened too much on the journey, then walked over, trying to muster as much insouciance as she could. "You've changed, Granny." He had looked at her quizzically as she approached, as if assessing whether he had the right girl. Now he smiled and held out his good hand. This involved putting the card on the desk first. "Sabine." "I'm Tom." "You're older than I thought." "Your grandma said you would be." He shook his head. "Well, she couldn't come because the Duke's got the vet in, so I'm your chauffeur."
"The Duke," she said. He had the kind of lilting Irish accent you thought only existed in television series, she thought briefly. Her grandmother didn't have an Irish accent at all. She tried not to look at the plastic hand. It had the waxy complexion of something dead.
"The old horse, her boy. He's got a problem with his leg, and she doesn't like anyone else looking after him. But she said she'll see you at the house."
So her grandmother, whom she hadn't seen for nearly 10 years, had chosen not to come and meet her, but look after some mangy horse. Sabine felt her eyes prick unexpectedly with tears. Well, that told her all she needed to know about how her visit was viewed.
"She's a bit hard over him," said Tom carefully, as he took her bag from her. "I wouldn't read anything into it. I know she's looking forward to seeing you."
"Some way of showing it," said Sabine, then glanced quickly at Tom to see if he thought her sulky. She cheered up briefly when they walked outside. Not so much because of the car, a huge battered Land Rover, although it was obviously cooler than Mum's, but its cargo. 2 huge chocolate-brown Labradors, as silky and sinuous as seals, squirming around each other in their passionate attempts to greet those returning.
"Bella and Bertie, mother and son. Go on, get over, you daft animal."
"Bertie?"
She couldn't help grimacing, even as she rubbed the 2 adoring heads, trying to steer the wet noses from her face.
"They're all B's, down the line, like hounds. Except the hounds are all H's."
Sabine didn't like to ask what he was talking about. She hoisted herself into the front of the car and strapped herself in. She wondered, with a little concern, how Tom was going to drive without his arm. Erratically, as it turned out. But as they careered around the grey streets of Rosslare, then onto the main road towards Kennedy Park, she realised she couldn't be entirely sure whether that was down to his insecure grip on the gear stick. His hand clasped it like an ill-fitting hard hat, rattling quietly against the plastic cover as the car bumped along the rough roads.
As a route home, she decided, it was less than promising.
The drizzly, cramped streets of the port town contained no shops she could imagine wanting to hang out in, being stuffed, as far as she could see, with old ladies stiffly upholstered underwear or car parts, while outside it seemed to be all hedgerow, dotted by modern bungalows bearing a sprinkling of satellite dishes like some strange fungi sprouting from the brick. It didn't even feel like proper countryside. There was a park to a dead president, but she couldn't see herself becoming desperate enough for greenery that she needed to use it.
Is there anything to actually do in Wexford? She asked Tom. And he turned briefly towards her and laughed. His mouth curled reluctantly around it, as if it didn't happen too often.
"Our big city girl is bored already, is she?" he said, but it was in a friendly way, so she didn't mind. "Don't worry. By the time you leave here, you'll be wondering what there is to do in the city."
Somehow she doubted it. To take her mind off her nerves, Sabine thought about Tom's arm, which was resting now on the handbrake next to her. She'd never met anyone with a false limb. Would it be attached to him with some kind of glue, or would he pull it off at night? Would he put it in a glass of water, like her neighbour Margaret's false teeth? And then there were the practical things. How would he put on his trousers?
She had once broken her arm and found it impossible to do up her flies one-handed. She had had to ask her mother to do it for her.
She found herself stealing a look at his fly to see whether there was some sort of Velcro fastening, then glanced away quickly. He might think she was perving at him, and nice as he was, she had no intention of a bit of one-armed banditry while she was here. In the event, Tom spoke to her only once more, to ask her how her mother was. Sabine looked at him in surprise.
How do you know her? You must have been here forever.
Not quite, but I was around as a lad. And then I left to work in England a couple of years after she did.
She never mentioned you.
She realized as soon as it came out how rude it sounded, but he didn't seem offended.
When he spoke, she had noticed, he did so with a kind of permanent time delay, as if measuring the words before he allowed them out.
I don't know how much she'd remember me. I worked in the yard, and she was never a great one for the horses.
Sabine gazed at him, desperate to ask more questions.
It seems somehow strange to picture her mother here, friends perhaps with his one-armed horseman.
She could only ever picture Kate in an urban environment, in their house in Hackney, its stripped floors, spider plants and art show posters broadcasting their liberal lower-middle-class credentials, or eating in one of the ethnic cafes in Kingsland Road, chatting earnestly to her long-earinged, angry female friends, trying to put off the ugly moment when she had to go back to writing her piece. Or arriving home in raptures from some arty film she had seen at the cinema, while Jeff, ever the realist, complained about its diversion from the German school's traditional imagery, or whatever. Thinking of Jeff made her stomach clench, and, annoyingly, provoked a renewed fluttering of nerves. She wondered briefly if he would try to write to her. Somehow, knowing that he and Mum weren't going to be together any more made it all awkward. She didn't know how to be with him any more. He would probably find some new girlfriend within months, like Jim. Then Mum would get dumped by Justin Stewartson and end up all bitter and upset and ask why men were such aliens. Well, she wasn't going to give her any sympathy. And she was never going to agree to go on holiday with Jeff if he got a new family, that was for sure.
Here we are, said Tom.
She had no memory of the house outside, apart from its size. From her childhood, she remembered the inside. All dark wood stairs and corridors that doubled back on themselves. The smells of wood smoke and wax and foxes' faces. She remembered the foxes' faces. Mounted and dated according to their demise, jutting from their little shields and snarling impotently from the walls. Aged 6, she had found them terrifying, and spent minutes at a time crouched on the stairs, waiting for someone to come past and give her the courage to race by them. From outside, she remembered only a mournful donkey who would bray incessantly when she walked away from its field, so that she felt blackmailed into staying. Her mum and Jim had thought she was in love with it and told everyone how sweet it was. She couldn't explain that she felt bullied by it and was relieved when someone made her go back inside the house. Now she noticed the exhausted-looking frontage of the house. The tall Georgian windows with peeling paint, the windowsills chipped and sagging like the mouth of an aging aunt. It had obviously been a grand house once, grander than anybody she knew, but it looked tired, steeped in decay, like someone who had stopped caring and was waiting simply for an excuse to go. It looks like I feel, Sabine thought, and felt an unexpected empathy.
Hope you've brought your woolies, said Tom out of the corner of his mouth as he hauled her back up the front steps. It's awful damp in there.
They waited some minutes after he rang the bell, and then the door opened and a tall woman stood before her, dressed in Wellingtons and tweedy trousers, rubbing bits of hay from her cardigan. She was old, her brow, nose and chin pushing past dignified pronouncement to the exaggeration of old age. But she stood tall and lean. When she held out her hands, her fingers were unexpectedly broad and close, like rough sausages.
Sabine, she said, smiling. As an afterthought, she held out her other hand, too, as if she was expecting a hug. I'm sorry I didn't meet you at the boat. It's been all go this afternoon.
Sabine didn't know whether to walk forward or not. Hello, she replied, unable to say granny. She rubbed at her hair awkwardly, unsure what to do with her hands.
Nice to see you.
Her grandmother withdrew her hands and stood, her smile looking a little stiffer.
Yes. Did you have a good trip over? That ferry can be awful. Can't bear it myself.
It was fine.
Sabine heard her own voice disappear to a whisper. She felt Tom's presence behind her, waiting, listening to this ridiculous exchange.
Bit rough, but not bad.
There was a lengthy pause.
Is your horse okay?
No, he's not really. Poor old boy. But we've given him some bute, so he should have a better night. Hello, Bella, old girl. Hello, hello. Yes, I know. Yes, Bella, you're a very good girl. Now, Bertie, don't you dare go upstairs.
Stooping to rub the gleaming coats of her dogs, the old lady turned and walked stiffly into the hall. Sabine stood and stared at Tom. He gestured to her to follow, and then, having dropped her bag on the step, saluted and tripped lightly back down the stairs. Filled suddenly with a childish urge to ask him not to go, Sabine stalled momentarily.
Her grandmother, she realized with some indignation, hadn't even thanked Tom for coming to get her. She hadn't even acknowledged him.
Sabine felt the first glimmerings of resentment, carried quietly since she had left London that morning, blossom into something more potent. She walked in slowly and closed the big door behind her. The scents and sounds of the hall hit her memory squarely with the strength of a demolition ball. Wax polish, old fabrics, the sound of the dog's claws clicking on the flagstone floor. Behind her grandmother, who was moving briskly along the corridor, she could hear the weighty tick of the grandfather clock, marking time at the same distant pace that it had done on her last visit a decade ago. Except the sight part was different. Now her height allowed her to see above the tables where the bronze horses stood in rest or paused mid-flight across bronze hedges. On the walls were oil paintings of other horses, mostly referred to by their first names, Sailor, Witch's Fancy, Big Dipper, like the portraits of half-remembered family members. Somehow she found them comforting. I wasn't nervous then, she told herself. And she's just my grandmother, for God's sake. She's probably nervous about having me to stay, about guessing what will make me comfortable. But she seemed to hide it pretty well.
We've put you in the blue room, she said upstairs, motioning into a room at the far end of the landing. The heating's not terribly good, but I've got Mrs. H. to lay you a fire, and you'll have to use the downstairs bathroom because the hot water's given up in here. I couldn't give you the good room because your grandfather's in it, and the downstairs one has mould on the walls.
Sabine tried not to shiver in the thin cold of neglect, and gazed around the room, a curious hybrid of the 1950s and 1970s. The blue chinoiserie wallpaper had at some point been matched optimistically to a more modern turquoise shagpile carpet. The curtains, threaded with gold brocade, dragged along it as if they had come from a much larger window. An old sink stood on stiff cast-iron legs in the corner, with a thin pale green towel hanging close to the fireplace. A watercolour of a horse and cart hung above the mantelpiece, while a larger, badly done portrait of a young woman, who might have been Sabine's mother, was on the wall close to the bed. She kept glancing behind her at the door, conscious of her grandfather's silent presence just a few doors away.
"There are a few bits in the wardrobe, but there should be plenty of room for your things. Is that all you brought?"
Her grandmother looked down at her bag, and then around her, as if expecting something else. Sabine paused.
"Do you have a computer?"
"A what?"
"Do you have a computer?"
Sabine realized as she spoke that she knew the answer. She should have known it from this room.
"A computer? No, no computers here. What do you need a computer for?"
Her voice was brusque, uncomprehending.
"For email. Just to keep in touch with home."
Her grandmother appeared not to hear.
"No," she repeated, "we don't have any computers here. Now, if you unpack your things, we'll have some tea, and then you can go and see your grandfather."
"Is there a television?"
Her grandmother gave her a searching look.
"Yes, there is a television. Your grandfather has it in his room at the moment, because he likes to watch the late news. I'm sure you can borrow it occasionally."
By the time they walked into the drawing room, Sabine had sunk under a black cloud of depression. Even the arrival of Mrs. H., short, plump, and sweet-smelling as her home-baked bread and scones, could not lift her mood, despite the friendly inquiries about the Irish Sea crossing, her mother's state of health, and Sabine's happiness with the bedroom arrangements.
There was no escaping it. Tom appeared to be the youngest person there, and he was the same age as her mother. There was no cable television, no computer, and she hadn't yet worked out where they kept the phone. And Amanda Gallagher was going to steal Dean Baxter before she could make it home. It was what hell must be like.
When she re-emerged into the drawing room, her grandmother didn't seem to be much happier. She kept looking, unseeing, around the room as she ate, as if trying to work out some distant problem. Periodically, she would stand up stiffly from the easy chair, walk briskly to the door, and shout some instruction at either Mrs. H., or some other unidentified person, so that after the fourth time, Sabine decided that her grandmother wasn't used to having tea, and felt it something of an imposition to have to sit there with her granddaughter for that long. She didn't ask about her mother, not once.
"Do you need to see to your horse?"
she said eventually, figuring that would give them both an easy exit. Her grandmother eyed her with relief.
"Yes, yes, you're right. I should check on the old boy. Very good."
She stood up, brushing crumbs from her trousers, and the dogs immediately leapt up to check the carpet. She strode to the door, then turned round.
"Do you want to have a look? Come and see the stables."
Sabine was desperate to disappear, so that she could indulge her burgeoning misery in private, but she knew it would be considered rude.
"All right, then," she said grudgingly.
Her Dean Baxter depression could wait another half hour. The donkey had long gone.
"Laminitis, poor old boy,"
said her grandmother, as if she should understand. But the rest of the yard had an air of familiarity. It was certainly livelier than inside the house. Along the row of stables, two slight, stooped men moved with bristling brooms and clattering buckets, dividing up a bale of hay into square sections, while behind them horses' hooves scraped on cement floor or thumped against wooden boards. A thin, tinny transistor, balanced on an upturned bucket, spewed fuzzy tunes in the background. Staring at the scene, Sabine had a vague memory of being lifted up to one of the doors, and of squealing in delighted horror when one of the huge, long faces loomed out of the darkness to see her.
"I assumed you'd be too tired to ride today, but I've hired you a tidy little gelding from New Ross. He'll do you while you're here."
Sabine's mouth dropped open.
"Ride? I haven't ridden for ages," she stuttered. "Not since I was a kid. I mean, Mum didn't tell me."
"Well, we'll take a look in the boot room later. What size are you? 4, 5? Your mother's old ones might fit you."
"It's been about 5 years. I gave up.
Yes, it's a complete bore trying to ride in London, isn't it? I once went to that stables in Hyde Park. Had to cross a main road even to get to the grass.
Her grandmother strode across the yard and berated one of the stable hands for the job he had made of the straw bed.
But I don't think I really want to.
She didn't hear. She had taken a broom from one of the men and was showing him how to sweep with short, angry strokes.
Look, I'm not really that fond of riding any more.
Sabine's voice cut across the noise, thin and high-pitched, so that everyone turned at the sound. Her grandmother stopped in her tracks and wheeled slowly around to face her.
What? I don't like it. Riding. I've sort of grown out of it.
The two stable hands looked at each other, one with a hint of a smirk. What she had just said had obviously been Wexford code for I murder babies, or I wear my knickers inside out to save on washing. Sabine felt herself blushing and cursed herself for it. Her grandmother stared at her blankly for a minute, then turned away back towards the stables.
Don't be ridiculous, she muttered.
Dinner's at 8 o'clock sharp. Your grandfather will be joining us, so don't be late.
Sabine cried for almost an hour, unheard in her damp, distant room. She cursed her bloody mother for sending her to this stupid place.
Cursed her stiff, unfriendly grandmother and her stupid bloody horses. And cursed Tom for letting her believe briefly that it might not be so bad after all.
Then she cursed Amanda Gallagher, who she just knew would be getting off with Dean Baxter, even as Sabine lay there. The Irish ferry system for not shutting down when the weather was crap, and the turquoise shag pile for being so hideous that if anyone ever found out she had stayed in a room that looked like this, she would have to emigrate. Forever. Then she sat up and cursed herself for getting purple and blotchy and snotty when she cried, instead of looking sad in the kind of clear-skinned, big-eyed, melancholy way that men found irresistible.
"My whole life is a bloody, bloody mess," she wailed, then cried some more, because it sounded so much sadder out loud.
Sabine's grandfather was already seated at the dining table when she came slowly down the stairs. She saw his stick before she saw him, jutting underneath the table between his legs. Then, as she came around the corner of the dining room, she saw his back, curved as if into a question mark, resting uncomfortably against the tall-backed dining chair, cushioned by a tartan blanket. The table was laid for three, the vast expanse of mahogany glowing between them, but he was just sitting in the candlelight, staring at nothing.
"Ah,"
he said slowly, as she moved into his field of view.
"You're late. Dinner is at 8. 8.
A bony finger gestured towards the wall clock, which informed Sabine that she was some 7 minutes late. Sabine gazed back at him, unsure whether to apologize.
"Well, sit down, sit down," he said, lowering his hand gently onto his lap.
Sabine looked around her, then sat opposite him. He was the oldest man she had ever seen. His skin, through which you could almost make out the shape of his skull, was beyond wrinkled. It had divided into hundreds of tiny crevices, like a wetland parched for decades. A thin vein pulsed above his temple, bulging like a worm cast under his skin. Sabine found she could barely look at him. It was somehow too painful.
"So,"
his voice trailed downwards, as if exhausted by its own flight,
"you're young Sabine."
It didn't seem to require an answer. Sabine merely looked accepting.
"And how old are you?"
Even his questions trailed downwards.
"I'm 16," she said.
"What?"
"I'm 16.
16,
she said. Oh, God, he was deaf as well.
"Ah, 16.
He paused.
Good.
Her grandmother appeared from a side door. Oh, you're here. Right, I'll bring in the soup. In that, you're here, she also managed to let Sabine know she was considered late. What was wrong with these people, thought Sabine miserably. It wasn't as if they were being timed. The dogs have had one of your slippers, her grandmother called from the next room. But her grandfather didn't appear to hear. Sabine, after some internal struggle, decided not to pass the message on. She didn't want to be responsible for the result. The soup was vegetable, real stuff rather than canned, with lots of visible bits of potato and cabbage. She ate it, even though she would have refused it at home, because the cold house had made her hungry. It was, she had to admit, rather good. Feeling the need to make some sociable comment as the three of them sat in silence, she pushed herself slightly upright and said, "The soup is nice." Her grandfather lifted his face slowly, draining his soup noisily from his spoon. The whites of his eyes, she noticed, were almost completely milky.
"What?"
"The soup," she said louder. "It's very nice." Some 9 minutes late, the clock in the hall announced that it was 8 o'clock. An unseen dog let out a shuddering sigh. The old man turned his face to his wife.
"Is she talking about the soup?"
Her grandmother didn't look up.
"She says it's nice," she affirmed loudly. "Oh, what is it?" he said. "I can't taste it. Vegetable."
Sabine found herself listening to the clock ticking in the hall. It seemed to be getting louder.
"Vegetable? Did you say vegetable?"
"That's right." Long pause.
"It doesn't have sweet corn in it, does it?"
Her grandmother dabbed at her mouth with her linen napkin.
"No, dear, no sweet corn. Mrs. H knows you don't like sweet corn."
He turned back to his bowl as if examining the contents.
"I don't like sweet corn," he said slowly to Sabine. "Horrid stuff."
Sabine, by now, was fighting an almost hysterical urge to laugh and cry at the same time. She felt as if she was trapped in some terrible third-rate television program where time froze and no one ever escaped. "I've got to go home," she told herself silently. "There's no way I can put up with nights and nights of this. I'll wither up and die. They'll find me mummified in a room with turquoise carpet, and they won't be able to work out whether I died from cold or boredom. And I'm missing all the best telly."
"Do you hunt?"
Sabine glanced up at her grandfather, who had finally finished his soup. A thin, opaque trail of it was visible at the side of his mouth. "No," she said quietly.
"What?"
"No, I don't hunt."
"She speaks very quietly," he said loudly to his wife. "She should speak up a bit."
Her grandmother, having gathered the empty plates, walked diplomatically out of the room.
"You speak very quietly," he said. "You should speak up. It's very rude."
"I'm sorry," said Sabine loudly and not a little defiantly. "Stupid old sod."
"So who do you hunt with?"
Sabine glanced around her, wishing suddenly for the return of her grandmother.
"I don't," she half shouted. "I live in Hackney. It's in London. There's no hunting."
"No hunting?"
"No."
"Oh."
He looked rather shocked, as if no hunting were an entirely new concept.
"So where do you ride?"
"Oh, God, but this was impossible." "I don't," she said. "There isn't anywhere to ride."
"So where do you keep your horse?"
"She doesn't keep a horse, dear," said her grandmother, coming in with a large silver tray, covered by the kind of silver dome Sabine had thought was restricted to comedy butlers. "She and Catherine live in London."
"Oh, yes. London, isn't it?
Oh, Mum, come and get me, Sabine willed. I'm sorry I was so mean about you and Jeff and Justin. Just come and get me. I promise I'll never moan about anything ever again. You can have endless streams of unsuitable boyfriends, and I'll never say anything. I'll stay on and do A-levels. I'll even stop stealing your perfume.
Now, Sabine, do you like it rare or well done?
Her grandmother lifted the silver dome so that the brown, sizzling mound of beef released its aroma into the still air. It was surrounded by a ring of roast potatoes and squatted in a shallow lake of rich brown gravy.
You can have either, dear. I'll carve. Come on, I don't want it to get cold.
Sabine stared at her in horror.
Mum didn't tell you, did she?
She said quietly.
Tell me what?
What?
Said her grandfather irritably.
What are you saying? Don't speak up.
Sabine shook her head slowly, wishing she did not have to see her grandmother's taut, exasperated expression.
I'm a vegetarian.
Chapter 2. It was really quite simple. Apparently, if one took a bath in the downstairs bathroom, as opposed to the upstairs one, which had obviously been installed when the house was built, and had last seen hot water around then, too, then one removed all evidence of one's visit within 5 minutes of finishing one's ablutions. That meant all damp towels, shampoo bottles, flannels, even toothbrushes and toothpaste. Or one could expect to find them dumped outside one's bedroom less than half an hour afterwards. If one wanted breakfast, then one made sure one was downstairs in the breakfast room by 8:30, not the dining room, of course, and not at 9:15, by which stage half of the day had gone, and Mrs. H. had much better things to do than to wait around while everyone had their breakfast, although she was too nice to say so herself. And one had porridge, followed by toast, with honey or marmalade, both of which sat in little silver pots, and no, there was no Alpen or Pop-Tarts. And one didn't complain about the cold. One dressed properly and didn't wander around wearing next to nothing and wittering on that it was draughty. That meant thick jumpers and trousers. And if one didn't have enough of them, then one only had to say so, because there were lots of spares sitting in the bottom of the big chest of drawers, and only a rude person would comment on how musty they smelt, or that they looked like they had last been worn by Albanian orphans sometime before one was born. And that went for footwear, too. One could not expect to wear expensive training shoes around the place and keep them box fresh. One should go to the boot room and find oneself a sturdy pair of Wellingtons. And if one was going to get hysterical about spiders, then one should shake the things out first. This was all without the rules of which one should not have to be reminded, like not letting the dogs upstairs, or keeping one's boots on in the drawing room, or turning over the television so that it wasn't on Grandfather's favourite news channel, or beginning to eat before everyone had been served, or using the phone without asking first, or sitting on the arga to keep warm, or having a bath in the evening, or at a depth any greater than 6 inches. A week into her stay, Sabine found there were so many rules to remember, it was as if the house itself were a person, as seemingly pernickety and set in its ways as her grandparents. At home, she had grown up with almost no rules. Her mother had taken a perverse satisfaction in letting her structure her own life, a kind of Montessori existence, so that faced with these never-ending and seemingly incomprehensible strictures, Sabine found herself increasingly resentful and depressed. That was until Tom taught her the most important rule, which returned some small measure of freedom to her life. Never, ever attempt to traverse any distance within the house or grounds at a pace slower than the Kilcarrion walk. This was a brisk, purposeful gait, to be conducted with chin lifted and eyes focused on the middle distance, which, if carried out at the correct speed,
serve to deflect any of the questions such as, "Where are you going?" or more commonly, "What are you doing? Come on, you can help me muck out this stable. Fetch the horses in, unhook the trailer, hose out the dog shed."
"It's not just you," said Tom. "She doesn't like to see anyone idle. Gets her anxious. That's why we all do it."
Now that Sabine thought about it, she realized it was true. She had never seen anyone in the house, with the exception of her grandfather, moving at anything less than a rate of knots. And as she had only seen the old man sitting, she couldn't be sure about him. But it wasn't just the house and its labyrinthine rules. Sabine, cut off from her friends, with only one brief, unsatisfactory telephone call to her mother, felt isolated and removed from everything she had known. She was an alien in these surroundings, as nonplussed by her elderly relatives as they were by her. She had left the house and its grounds just once so far, to accompany her grandmother to a kind of hypermarket in the nearest town, where, had she been inclined, she could have purchased anything from processed cheese to white plastic garden furniture. There was that, and a post office, and a tack shop for horse stuff. No McDonald's, no cinema, no arcade, no magazines. Seemingly no people under the age of 30. With the Daily Telegraph and the Irish Times her only contact with the outside world, she didn't even know what was number one in the charts. Her grandmother, if she noticed Sabine's steady descent into depression, had evidently decided to ignore it, or treat it as some kind of teenage foible. She organized Sabine at the beginning of each day, giving her a succession of tasks, such as dropping off papers to the kennels, or fetching vegetables from the kitchen garden for Mrs. H, and treated her with the same brisk detachment with which she treated everyone around her, except the dogs, that was, and, more significantly, the Duke. That had been their worst falling out so far, worse than her grandmother's insistence that vegetarianism couldn't possibly embrace chicken. It had come 2 days later when, swinging on the door as the Duke was led stiffly back into his stable, Sabine had forgotten, as requested, to kick the bottom bolt across, and had subsequently to watch aghast as, with a skittishness worthy of a much younger and less lame animal, the old bay horse had worked loose the top bolt with his teeth and made his elegant bid for freedom across the yard to the open fields beyond. It had taken her grandmother and both lads, with the aid of 6 apples and a bucket of bran mash, almost 2 hours to catch him, tramping grimly around the top fields as he came tantalizingly close and veered away again, tail held high like a banner of defiance. When, as it began to get dark, he eventually strolled over, head low with exhaustion and sporting an air of something like embarrassment, he was limping badly. Her grandmother had been furious, at first shouted at her that she was a stupid, stupid girl, and then, almost tearfully, had focused all her attention on her boy, alternately rubbing his neck and scolding him in soft tones as they walked stiffly back towards the stables.
"What about me?"
Sabine, now tearful herself, had wanted to yell at her departing back.
"I'm your bloody granddaughter, and you've never said so much as a kind word to me."
That had been the point at which Sabine had begun plotting her escape, and avoiding her grandmother, who managed, while never again referring to the incident, to make Sabine feel the weight of her disapproval. She had not tried to hug Sabine after that. In fact, she had found it hard to say anything much to her for a day or two. Her mood only lifted when the vet announced that the inflammation in the Duke's leg was on its way down. So Sabine spent most of her time with Tom and the 2 lads, Liam and John John, both of whom, like Mrs. H, were some kind of distant relatives. Liam was a libidinous former jump jockey, almost incapable of saying anything that didn't swell into double entendre, while John John, his 18-year-old protégé, was almost silent, his desperation to graduate into the nearby racing yard etched into his prematurely weather-beaten skin. Tom, although too quiet, seemed to understand Sabine's frustration and resentment, and would occasionally puncture it with gentle mockery. She had already stopped noticing his arm, which was covered to the wrist by jackets and jumpers. He was someone to talk to.
"So I waited till bloody 10:30, until I was sure the old man had finished with the bathroom, and then there was no hot water left at all. Nothing. I was so cold by the time I got out of the bath that my feet were blue. Really. And my teeth were chattering."
Hanging over the stable door, she kicked at a bucket, sending a small wave over its battered edge. Tom, raking down the clean straw that had been piled up along the wall, stopped and raised an eyebrow, and she climbed down, glancing unconsciously over at the Duke as she did so.
"There's no hairdryer, so my hair's gone all flat, and my sheets are damp. Really damp. Like when I get into the bed, I have to peel the top sheet and the bottom sheet apart. And they smell of mould."
"How can you tell?"
"How can I tell what?"
"That they smell of mould. Yesterday you told me that the whole house smelled of mould. The sheets might actually smell quite nice."
"You can see it. Green spots."
Tom guffawed, still raking his straw. "It's probably the pattern on the sheets. I'll bet you've got eyesight like your mother." Sabine stared at him, letting go of the door.
"How do you know about my mother's eyesight?"
Tom rested his rake against the wall. He bent and removed the bucket from under Sabine's foot, waiting for her to move out of the way before he sluiced the water across the yard. "You're all blind, your whole family. Everyone knows. I'm surprised you don't wear glasses."
Tom was like that. You'd think you had the measure of him, talk to him like he was a mate, and then every now and then he'd throw in some piece of information about her mother or his own past, and she'd find herself silenced, trying to make this new piece of information fit into the recognisable whole. The things she knew about him, some gleaned from him, some from Mrs. H., who was a veritable broadcasting network when not in her grandmother's presence, were that he was 35, that he had spent some years in England working for a racing yard, that he had returned under some kind of a cloud, and that he had lost his arm through riding. The latter had not come from him. Easy-going as he was, she did not yet feel brave enough to quiz him about his amputation. But Mrs. H. had told her that she always thought the horses would be the death of him. "He has no fear, you see. No fear. His father was the same." She didn't know the full story, as she didn't like to burden her sister. His poor mother. But it was something to do with when he used to ride over the sticks. "Sticks," Sabine had said, picturing a picket fence. "Had he impaled himself?"
"Fences. He was a jump jockey. It's a damn sight more dangerous than on the flat. I'll tell you that for nothing."
"Everything here revolved around horses," thought Sabine grimly. "They were all bloody obsessed, to the point where they thought nothing of losing bits of their own bodies."
She had so far managed to put off riding the grey horse in the back field, telling her grandmother that she had backache. But she knew from her grandmother's impatient expression, the way she had already fished out an old pair of riding boots and a hat and left them pointedly outside her bedroom door, that she was living on borrowed time. Sabine didn't want to ride. The thought of it made her feel sick. She had managed to persuade her mother that she should give it up years ago, after the weekly drive to the stables had gradually found her becoming nauseous with nerves. Morbidly, and usually correctly, convinced that this was the week that she would have to ride one of the evil riding school horses, the ones that bolted and bucked and chased the others with slicked back ears and bared teeth, and that this was the week where she would be carried off, out of control, her legs flapping, unbalanced against the saddle, her arms hauling back in vain on the reins. It wasn't a challenge, like the other girls seemed to find it. It wasn't even fun. And Kate hadn't even seemed to fight her when Sabine said she didn't want to do it any more. As if she had only made her daughter do it out of some uncertain sense of family tradition. "I don't want to ride," she confided to Tom, as he led one of the tethered horses back into its stable. "You'll be fine. That little lad's a real gent." Sabine glanced over at the distant grey.
I don't care what he is. I don't want to ride. Do you think she'll make me?
He's grand. Get on him a couple of times and you'll be fine.
You're not bloody taking me seriously, she half shouted,
so that John John in the next stable stuck his head around the door.
I don't want to ride the horse. I don't want to ride any horse. I don't like it.
Tom calmly unhooked the lead rein from the horse and gave it an appreciative slap on its rump with his good hand. He walked over to her, closing and bolting the door behind him. You frightened her.
I just don't like it.
There's nothing wrong with losing your nerve. Most of us have done it at some point.
Can't you hear me? God, you people! I just don't like riding.
Tom placed his fake hand on her shoulder. It rested there, stiff and unyielding, curiously at odds with the sentiment it was trying to convey. You know, she won't be satisfied until you've at least had a go.
It'll make things heat.